What can we know? The sixth talk at Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know?, was presented by David Crabtree on July 14, 2012. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
It is a very curious thing that we are the beneficiaries of millennia of human thought, and yet we've reached the place where we don't know anything. We have lost confidence that we can know anything. We are skeptical. We are the victims. And I know this from talking to our students, that this is much the way they feel. They are the victims of marketing at every turn. Everything has spin. They've come to distrust or mistrust everyone and everything. And therefore, the best response is to withhold commitment and just float. How did we get here? If you haven't noticed, the world has changed in recent years. And that change, that process of change, seems to be speeding up. I'm not going to list all of the changes that have occurred. There are just a few here that I want to point out. But they are all things that affect how we think about ourselves and how we think about truth. The first is just lumping together all of the technological changes. One of the things that's happened in all of the technological changes is that they have blurred the distinction between what is real and what is virtual. And it raises the question in our minds as to what is real. Another kind of change is socio-political changes, globalization, and democratization. As a result of both of those processes, we feel smaller, less significant, more burdened, and more powerless in the face of such big forces. Along and in accordance with those changes, education has changed. Education in our time is now vocational training. And along with that is a heavy emphasis on conformity of behavior and ideas rather than on the older concept of maturity and wisdom. And central to all of these changes is that we have come to the place where we are no longer certain that there is truth. God either doesn't exist or is irrelevant. And as a result, as human beings, we have been reduced to insignificant animals with a soul and a conscience. And that's a terrible combination. Much of this has happened since the Enlightenment. If we date it to the 1600s, the project that developed in the Enlightenment was for human beings to use their rationality to understand the world in which we live and to shape it to our liking. Curiously, it started with the belief that there is a God and that because there is a God and a creator, that there is an ordered universe that can be known. It's not random, it's ordered, it's lawful. But along the way, we rejected God as an inconvenience, but continued with that pursuit of trying to figure reality out so that we could conform it for our purposes. Over time, this whole enterprise proved itself to be dehumanizing, and it proved itself to be dangerous. And as a result, culture responded against the Enlightenment and rejected the whole notion of truth. So where does that leave us? It leaves us lonely, confused, full of self-doubt. We have a grab bag of beliefs with no coherence, but we have strongly held opinions. And we are open to all kinds of ideas, both innocent and dangerous, and we could be characterized as a society that is gullible and naive. Can we get out? As a society, I honestly don't know. As individuals, absolutely. How do we get out? We need to recognize that truth exists and work to find it. Truth exists and we can know it. This is common sense in the sense that Reed used the term. That is to say that we are born with these assumptions and we can't get away from them. We all operate on them. It is merely an intellectual game to say that we don't believe that truth exists and that we can't know it. If that's true, then how do we know? Well, we all know how to know. We do it from the day that we're born. We operate on the basis of the dictates of common sense in the way that Reed is using the term. This includes the assumptions that reality is a rationally constructed, coherent whole. There is unity and coherence to that which is out there. That reality was made to be known. And that I was made to be a knower of reality. And that I am capable of reasoning relatively competently. So, we apply reason to our experience and to the evidence of the world out there, and we start figuring it out. And when I say reason, I'm talking about reason in the more holistic sense. Reason during the Enlightenment was truncated down to logical inference. But that is not all that reason does. Reason is a much broader concept than that. We know that. We use a much more broader range of reasoning abilities. So in addition to logical inference, it includes, and these are terms that Dorothy Sayers used, imagination and intuition. But all of those together make up human reason. Then we use reason according to a process that's similar to the scientific method. The scientific method didn't come out of nowhere. The scientific method is based on the way that we investigate all kinds of issues in life. We posit a hypothesis. And then we see if it stands up to new information. But we're constantly making changes and judgments as to whether that hypothesis is holding or is it not holding. As it shows to be inadequate, we make adjustments to that hypothesis. We keep working on it until we reach that point of what Chris called fittedness. It's when the pieces all fit together and we sense that the pieces have all fit together, then we have confidence. To the extent that they're all fitting together, we have more confidence than if they aren't fitting together. Remembering, and this is, Bill pointed this out, that the goal is to get it right, not to save face. But there's a humility that's involved in prioritizing the value of getting it right over everything else is critical in the process. There are a couple of legacies of the Enlightenment that we need to be aware of. And this has been talked about a couple of times. Ron mentioned it, and so did Chris, and so did Casey on the first day. That logical certainty that we are attracted to logical certainty based on empirical observation. We are not going to get logical certainty based on empirical observation. That's a phantom. Another legacy of the Enlightenment that we have to fight against is the concept that knowledge is objective, purely objective, rather than being a series of subjective judgments. That those judgments, those are a good and proper part of the process, rather than something that should be weeded out of the process. Okay, I'm just going to make a few comments about the process of knowing. There's much that could be said, and if there are questions, this is something that we could get into more, but these are the five things that I thought would be most significant, most deserved mentioning. The first is we need all ways of knowing. We've talked about art, we've talked about science, We've talked about theology. We've talked about philosophy. Those are all avenues of knowing. And if you believe that truth is a coherent whole, then what you find through one of those avenues ought to be consistent with what you find through the other avenues. It makes all kinds of sense that we would use all of the avenues to try to get a picture of the whole. It's like placing some object out in front of us, and each of those avenues is looking at that whole from a different angle. And you are not going to get a good picture of that object that's out there in front of us unless you look at it from all of the angles. We live in an age of specialization. And specialization causes myopia. Specialization leads to a situation where you can't see the forest for the trees. If you just focus on the tree, then you are going to miss out on a very important piece of information that you need to understand that tree, and that is the whole in which it is contextualized. I will just point out, that's why in our culture it is so important to resurrect the liberal arts. Dorothy Sayers mentioned that. Hayek in The Road to Serfdom points that out. Jacques Ellul points that out. There are others that have made that same observation. But if we don't understand the various approaches to truth, the various avenues to truth, we are going to misunderstand the object that's out before us. And if we have a culture that doesn't appreciate that, we're headed for trouble. And it occurred to me while I was thinking through this, I suspect that the decline in interest in the liberal arts probably is related to a decline in the appreciation for the wholeness of truth. If truth isn't a coherent whole, then there's not the motivation to make sure that we understand the different avenues towards truth. Second, it is very important as we're thinking through an understanding of truth and reality that we need to keep track of our grounds for our conclusions. The way I think about this is it's like walking across a frozen lake. It is really helpful to keep track of the signs as to when you are on thin ice and when you're on thick ice. When you are on thick ice, you can jump up and down, you can drive a truck on it. But there are other places where you go where you're on really thin ice and you better be careful how you walk. We need to know the basis for the truths that we embrace. Are they well-grounded or are they not well-grounded? And I think that we're faced with a situation that is, I find, very curious. We've actually created an environment in which we take an enormous number of things on authority. When you listen to the news at night, how do you know it's true? You're taking their word for it. When you see the pictures on the screen, how do you know it's true? Because you're seeing it. As Malcolm Muggeridge said, the camera always lies. What he means by that is it's always just a little piece of the context. You've been robbed of the rest of the context, but you're used to thinking, if I see it, I know what's happening. I've also thought of something like our study of chemistry. This appears to me to be solid. I learned in chemistry that it isn't. I learned in chemistry that this is mostly space. Do I believe it? Sure. But I'm taking that on authority. I have not gone through the steps that would give me the confidence that what the chemists are telling me is true. We do that with all kinds of things. We've become used to accepting things on the basis of authority and just embracing that as just as true as everything else that we think that we know. I read a book by someone, I can't even remember his name, unfortunately, but he was making the observation that In the Middle Ages, a farmer farming his ground would have made a much greater distinction between that which he knew on the basis of his own personal experience and other things that he had heard. So, for instance, if you were to tell him something about his pigs, he would be able to tell you whether that fit with his experience or not. But if you told him that light up in the sky, which is Mars, is traveling around the sun, he'd say, could be, I don't know. I really don't have any experience that would really help me to evaluate that. And I suspect that we've created a situation in the modern society where that understanding of what is well-founded knowledge, stuff that I have good reason to believe, and that which I don't have good reason to believe, that those borders have been blurred in our time. And I think that our educational system has not helped us in that respect. I mean, when we first got some sheep, when we used to live on a farm, and a farmlet, and when we lived on our farmlet, we bought a booklet, and it was on how to raise sheep. And my wife and I were reading it because we didn't know anything about sheep, and we bought some sheep, so we were trying to figure out how do you do these things. And one of the things that it said in the book was, sheep don't eat at night. And I don't know why that really struck me, but it struck me when we were reading it. And about 2 months later, I went out into our pasture in the middle of the night, and I can't remember why, probably to fix something with the irrigation or something. I had this flashlight, and I was out in the middle of the field working on whatever it was that I had to go out to fix. And I heard a noise, and I could tell, well, the sheep are out here. And I raised up my flashlight, and these sheep are down chewing on grass. And I raised the flashlight, they all look up at me, and they're all chewing on this grass. And I went and told my wife, sheep do eat at night. And you can show me a stack of books this high that say that sheep don't eat at night, and I still will believe that sheep eat at night. Because I have experience of that. I know that sheep eat at night. They don't eat at night. Some questions, some issues in truth are more important than others. The questions like, what does it mean to be human? And is there a God? And if so, what kind of God is he? Those are critical. Those are right at the center of what we need to work out. When it comes to spending time figuring out reality, that's where we ought to devote the bulk of our time. Other questions, like how to make a better squirrel trap, are not as important unless one gets in the building. Fourth thing. Knowing is not just memorizing a set of facts. And it's taken me a long time to realize the significance of that truth really isn't the kind of thing that can be evaluated by a multiple choice test. Whether you know truth or not cannot be evaluated that way. Kierkegaard talked about two different kinds of understanding. That the first is becoming acquainted with the set of facts. The second is embracing those facts. The second is a disposition of the soul, ultimately. Notice that the first can be communicated. The second must be arrived at by each individual. We can be aided in this process, but ultimately each individual has to make that journey. And the fifth thing I want to point out, and this has been kind of a recent discovery on my part. The most important things we know are inarticulable. I suspect that I've discovered this in my old age when I start to forget the things that I used to know and realize how much smarter I used to be. But I think that it is nevertheless true that the most important things we learn are our skills, our dispositions of the heart, that are learned over a long period of time through a long set of experiences that bring us to the place where we are a changed person, and yet it's hard to point to any fact, any one fact that made that difference, or any set of facts that made that difference. It's a much more mysterious process that we are taken through to learn those kinds of things. And it's the kinds of things like learning faith and love, patience, etc. We don't know when we learn them, don't know precisely how we learn them, and we can't put in words exactly what we learned. But nevertheless, we've learned it, and we live our life accordingly. And it's a marvelous thing. A final note. Taking on the project of trying to come up with a model understanding of truth, one that's accurate, one that's consistent, one that's rational, is a big undertaking. There's an enormous amount that I don't know, there's an enormous amount that you don't know, and there's the real question, how much are we capable of figuring out? And whenever I think about this kind of thing, there's an image that I gain great solace from. And it was an image that was created by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. I hope you all can remember. You've probably all seen it at one time or another. But it's the creation of Adam. And there's this image of Adam kind of half reclining and kind of limply holding out his hand on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have God who's straining with every fiber of his being to try to make contact with Adam. The reason I find that so comforting is because that captures, I think, the nature of this process of trying to come to know what's truth. That we do what we can, as feeble and as inept as it is, but we can rest assured that we aren't in this process alone, that more than us wanting to know what is true, God wants us to know what is true. And God knows how to bring that about better than we do. He's the master teacher. And that he's working from his end to make truth known to us. And he's exerting more effort than we are in trying to learn the truth. And we can have confidence that he will do his job and that he will bring us to the point that we understand what he wants us to understand. Okay. That's all I had for comments. We're going to open it up for questions, but I'm hoping that this can be kind of a conversation more than just questions and answers. If you have questions, great. And if I can answer them, I will. If somebody else can answer them, they will. If you have a comment, that's great as well. Just whatever you want to talk about would be good.
I think one of the tragic things about, I don't know what to call it, I'm thinking in terms of a stew that has been on the heat for so long that all distinctions between the ingredients has long disappeared. Our culture and its certainty of superiority because it's today, and today is superior to all the yesterdays. Mm-hmm. The certainty that we can't know anything, which itself is a contradiction, mm-hmm. is thought to be the latest and greatest in truth. This is the pinnacle that we've arrived at, and it's tragic. It's
Jack was talking about the grand narrative. What is God? What is the story that God is telling in creation? And I am quite confident that one of the subplots of the story that is being told through human existence is that as we progress through history, it becomes clearer and clearer what kind of thing man is. And I find it interesting that man has reached such a pathetic state at this particular point in time. And that's, I think, what you would expect as you approach the end of the story. I mean, man, I should balance that out, because on the other hand, there's a sense in which man is a kind of pathetic, even wicked creature. But on the other hand, there's something actually amazing about mankind. And I think that you can see that in history as well. God created us in His image. And as beings in His image, there is a remarkable aspect to human beings. Our creativity, our conscience, our all kinds of things. But it is curious that we've reached a point in time when we see man at his most kind of pathetic self.
I was raised a Catholic, and when I was about 16, after asking a lot of questions and not getting any answers, I figured that God and Santa Claus had a lot in common. You know, be it ever seen them, and they give you, if you're good, they give you nice things, and if you're bad, they either throw you in hell or give you coal in your stocking. No reasonable adult believed in Santa Claus, so why would any reasonable adult believe in God? So I spent about 10 years as a functional atheist, although I called myself an agnostic. A lot of the choices I was making agnostic, meanings you can't know whether there's a God. But I still had to make decisions based on the answer to that question, whether it was true I could know or not. I needed to act as if there either was a God or wasn't a God. And a lot of times I was acting as if there wasn't a God. But at the same time, I consider myself a hopeful agnostic, in that if somebody had been able to show me that there was a God, that would have been just glorious news. So on the one hand, the fact that we have really lost our way as far as understanding that there's truth and how do we go about finding it and that kind of thing, we're very messed up in that respect. I suspect that is why we are the way we are, that is significant to God, not that we are. He's not going to ask me if I'm a card-carrying, when I show up at the pearly gates, if I'm a card-carrying member of the agnostic society. He's going to ask me why I was. That there can be people who believe exactly the same thing, and one of them believes it out of total rebellion, and one of them believes it because of a fundamental commitment to the truth, but he's confused as heck about what that is and if it's possible to find it. On the one hand, there's part of me that wants to say what's at stake there is our psychological comfort. Those of us who are hopeful agnostics, it's really uncomfortable position to be in, to have to wait till you actually see God to know that what you hoped for really was true. But I'm not sure. I think that's probably not completely right. I think that's part of it. Based on something I heard Jack say about our being existentially confronted with ideas, that these are important questions and it's important to engage each other. If I'm sometimes inclined to say, well, God knows people's hearts and that's what really counts. But sometimes where God encounters people is we get to be part of that existential question that God asks the person. We get to poke them and challenge them and that kind of thing. I was wondering if you could, since this is something I'm really still puzzling out, the difference between, okay, they're going to be okay, life's not going to be pleasant psychologically because they don't know the truth, but, you know, ultimately they're going to be okay, versus, I guess my question is, why should I try to persuade people that there is truth, that truth can be known, and that kind of thing? What's at stake there? Why should I do that?
Well, from my perspective, and others could chime in on this, but there's a sense in which I would say I personally don't feel as obligated to do that as I think I used to. That I am so convinced that important truths are best taught by God, however he chooses to do that, and that I don't feel the same need to jump in and make that happen the way that I did when I was being trained in Campus Crusade to do evangelism, on the one hand. But on the other hand, it is an enormous act of love to help people to understand the reality in which they live. And as a result, and it is fun to play a part in that. And so if it appears to me that there's an opportunity to play that kind of role, I eagerly take that opportunity. But what's happened over time is I'm much more sensitive to whether I think that I've got an opening or I don't. That by reading the person's responses and stuff, do I see any indications of being open to the truth or don't I? And if I see none at all, then I'm much less likely to jump in there. But if I see some kind of indication that there might be some openness, fantastic. Thank God for the opportunity. That's a lot of fun. Is that helpful? I don't know if anybody else wants to chime in.
In Jack's lecture, you talked about transcendent causation as opposed to ordinary causation. Would you be able to expand a little on transcendent causation? Can we know much more about transcendent causation?
Maybe the best way to answer that would be autobiographically. Just give a little intellectual diary of. I was wrestling with the argument of Romans, and I came upon Paul making an argument that didn't make any sense to me because it's an argument that I couldn't make. And it had to do with the confidence that he had that God was going to bring him into his inheritance, the blessing of his inheritance, because I had become convinced that a major part of the blessing that God wants to bring me into is to be the kind of person who freely chooses what's good. So I hunger and thirst after righteousness now. One day I'm going to be filled. Well, what does it mean to be filled with righteousness? Well, as a human being, a righteous human being is a human being who freely chooses to do what's good, to do what's obedient, to do what's godlike. But Paul is saying that hope can't fail. That hope can't disappoint. And I was trying to figure out, because everything in my theology at that point emphasized free will. We human beings have free will, and God cannot violate our free will. Everything I'd ever heard stressed that. Well, if God can't violate my free will, how can God guarantee that I'm going to freely choose righteousness at some point in my life? That made no sense to me. The whole spirit of the Christianity that I had been taught is God has done everything he can to lay this out on the table and make it available to you, but he can't make you choose it. That's kind of up to you. So make your choice, and hopefully you'll choose right. Well, did that stop when we die? You know, all of a sudden I've got free will till I die, and then I die, and then God takes away my free will and makes me righteous like a robot? You know, now I have to do righteousness because that's the inheritance God gave me. That just didn't make any sense to me. Why would it make sense for us to be free now, but when we finally come into the full realization of our humanity, God erases our freedom and we're no longer free? That doesn't make any sense. So I finally came to the conclusion, Paul must believe something that I don't believe. And the only thing I can think that he must believe that makes sense out of his argument is that God can cause me to freely choose him. or freely choose obedience or whatever it is I have to, or truth. But God can cause me to freely choose. And then I was at a dead end. But I said, I mean, it's kind of what David was talking about. Are we going to just accept what my culture has told me I have to believe? Or am I going to be willing to transcend my culture and believe things against the pressure of my culture? And I had enough of a commitment to biblical authority that if Paul believes that God can cause us to freely choose, then who am I to disagree with him? He's speaking for God here in the Bible. And so the concept of God causing us to freely choose, even though nothing in me can make sense out of that, I guess I have to bow to the fact that that's what the Bible teaches. God causes us to freely choose. Well, then I was stuck. I thought, okay, I'll believe that, but I can't make any sense out of it. But then it niggled at me, and then I realized, well, there is a kind of distinction that has to be made. It's one thing to cause somebody to do something through force and coercion of some kind, but what if God makes me freely choose something like from the inside, you know, not coercing me from the outside, but causes me to do it from the inside? And then I began to think about, well, God's the creator, you know, God doesn't put me in a half Nelson and make me do what I'm going to do. I choose what I choose thinking that I'm choosing it. Even if it's God causing me to do it, he makes me choose what I choose thinking that I'm choosing it. So what's that relationship? I mean, that's a sort of different kind of causation than coercion and our normal. The only way that I could ever impose my will on you is by some form of coercion. And that's what I call ordinary causation. But obviously God's not doing that. And that's not what Paul means. Paul is not saying that God coerces me. So what are we talking about? And that's when I, just for the sake of a mental tool, a concept to help me, I made a distinction between ordinary causation and the kind of causation that God is using, transcendent causation, from outside of me, working on the inside of me, instead of from outside of me coercing me from the outside. And then I thought, okay. And then literally one day I was taking a shower, having become convinced that, well, I'm never going to be able to prove or demonstrate or verify that transcendent causation is different than ordinary causation, because last time I checked, I wasn't transcendent, and I don't foresee it in the future. You know, I don't think I'm ever going to have that experience. And then one day, literally in the shower, it dawned on me, that's nonsense. We're all capable of transcendence over the works of our imagination. That whatever it is I bring into existence in my imagination, I have complete and total control over it. So like if I'm writing a novel, the characters of the novel live and move and have their being in me, the author. They literally, every fiber of their existence is utterly and completely under my control. And yet, as in a novel, what kind of creature might I create? One that's operating freely, that's exercising their free will. And then I was off and running. I mean, that's transcendent causation at work. And so if transcendent causation is a valid sort of relationship between an author and the characters in his novel, why can it not be a valid relationship between the creator, our creator, and us? Does that help?
I feel nervous speaking, but I just wanted to say that I have loved this conference, and the more I listen and the more I'm exposed to and the more knowledge and just changes in general, it's almost like I don't have the language anymore to express myself. I understand, and it's like I have a hard time. It's like I understand what is being said. It resonates with me. I know things intrinsically that are true. It's almost like the experience has validated what I have denied myself, really. There's a lot of things that have changed over the course of the last few years, but I just need to find the language in which to express it. And so, thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
Could you talk a little bit more about, you were saying that we've got many paths to knowledge. I hate to say that because it sounds so New Agey, but there's many, many ways that we need to use to explore reality and approach truth. Sometimes in Christian culture, you get the idea that some of those things aren't particularly valid. Art is kind of a waste of time, maybe. If you can't be a Bible teacher, well, you know, being a nuclear physicist is okay, but it's really much more superior to be a Bible teacher. I've known people who are very skilled in one area, but because the Christian culture didn't value that area and only valued, say, if you were a preacher and a, you know, a successful one at that and that kind of thing, that okay, well, if you have to build really great houses, okay, but if you were really together, you'd be a Bible preacher and you'd know Greek upside down and inside out and that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you could talk about how we decide what we should do with our life in terms of the big picture. How do you decide if you're, well, first of all, is that perspective that there really are some professions that you should really try to be a Bible teacher? If you can't do that, well, you've got second best. You know, maybe you could be an artist or build houses or something like that. Could you talk about whether that idea, interact with that idea a little bit, and then based on, are there certain endeavors that are more valuable or more noble or whatever, or not? How do I decide what I should do? Should I be an artist? Should I be a nuclear physicist? Should I, you know, what do I do?
There are two things that are really important to keep in mind. One is that for the things that we need to learn, the most important teacher of that, the one who can do that, is God. And the material that he uses primarily is human experience. And most people have that. So when God can bring about, God can teach us what he wants us to teach, regardless of whether we're a scientist, whether we're a Bible teacher, whatever. God is perfectly capable of teaching us what he needs to teach us. And he's got the material there, and he's got the ability to do it. The value for us as we think about trying to come to an understanding of the truth, we're doing our part, is that it just makes sense that with this truth, this object truth that's out in front of us, that we would look at it from different perspectives. That'll help us to understand the whole. So it just makes sense to me that we would be, to one degree or another, conversant in the various fields of inquiry towards truth. Do we need to become artists? No. Do we all need to become Bible teachers? No. Et cetera, et cetera. That we don't need to become those things. We don't need to devote ourselves to those things, but to become conversant in them so that I know what they can and cannot contribute to my understanding of the whole, that makes all kinds of sense to me. So what I'm advocating is we all need to be liberal artists. And I think that's important. In fact, my quote about what I said about we're all philosophers, it's just that some are good and some are bad, that was actually stolen from Robert Hutchins, who said we are all liberal artists. The only question is, are we good liberal artists or bad? And that's very true, I think. So I don't think that a pursuit of truth dictates that we should go into one of those fields of inquiry or another over another. I really don't. How do we decide? Well, circumstances of life. I mean, when I was in college, I wanted to be an interpreter. and I was studying Russian so that I could become an interpreter. And when I started in college, it was during detente, and there were a lot of jobs as a Russian interpreter. By the time I graduated, detente had finished, and all those jobs just disappeared. I have never become a Russian interpreter. Circumstances dictated that I would not become a Russian interpreter. And I think that that's largely what happens, is that it's desire, it's aptitude, and opportunity. Those three things steer us in one direction or another as we go through life. And all of those are the kinds of things that God uses to point us, to move us where he wants us to go. And I don't think there's any real magic to it. It's just a matter of trying to sort those out as best we can in the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Bye.